Well, here we are again, talking about healthcare. And yes, we've been doing that a lot lately, but the beauty of this show is that we can take something so complex, like the American healthcare system, and talk about different pieces of it and how they fit into our daily lives. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. Last week, we visited a skilled nursing facility and talked about what Medicaid means for Ohio's opioid crisis. This week, we're going to zoom out a little and think about healthcare at a macro level. Consider this what-if scenario. Specifically, what if you could swap our healthcare system for another country's? Like, for example, the National Health Service in the UK.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of the NHS, that's for sure. It's great.
That's Liz Noley, who was born in the US but made the move to the UK in 2015 with her husband, who's British. And so far, she really likes the NHS. Before that, Liz was living in Hartford, Connecticut, and she saw the U.S. healthcare system kind of from the inside.
My job, I worked as a contractor for, funnily enough, an insurance company in Hartford. My day-to-day was just seeing customer complaints, customer stories. It was just, you know, on a daily basis, you just hear the same story over and over again, which is that they couldn't find out, they couldn't get information to know what actually is covered. So there just seemed to be so much confusion out there and sort of different, getting different information and customers just trying to figure out where they stand, basically, with their policies.
When Liz made the move to the UK, healthcare wasn't the only reason, but it was definitely a plus. And the thing she found so shocking?
The NHS is just much easier in that it's sort of built around the user, it's built around the patient.
That meant, for Liz, that it was literally easy to use. As in, all she had to do was sign up, pay her tax dollars, or pounds, and then show up, which felt a little odd still.
I still have this sense of, like, I'm shoplifting or something when I'm leaving. I feel like, you know, someone's going to tap me on the shoulder and say, pardon me, ma'am, you know. But, yeah, you can just leave. It's fine. You don't have to pay anyone.
None of this is to say the NHS doesn't have its problems. It's been a key source of debate in the UK, chief complaints being wait times and access to some specialists. No health system is perfect. But let's say there are some ideas that we could borrow here in the US. Where would we start? First, we have to decide what makes a health system valuable in the first place, as in what criteria do we use. So we sat down with someone who compares healthcare systems for a living.
We look at the quality of care. We look at preventive care. We look at care.
That's Robin Osborne, vice president of the Commonwealth Fund. Her organization puts out a yearly report card on 11 national healthcare systems, including France, Germany, the UK, and, of course, the US.
If there was an Olympics for healthcare spending, we would sweep the gold, silver, and bronze. But we don't do that well on value. And I think, and getting the kinds of outcomes that we would hope to, given how much we spend, a starting point might be access. So the countries that we compare ourselves to all have universal coverage. And I think the first issue in values, you have to be able to get into the healthcare system. So in the U.S., we see that about a third of adults forego needed care. They don't see a doctor, they don't fill a prescription, they don't get follow-up tests and treatments because of costs. And the ACA has improved that a lot, but we're still the outlier compared to these other healthcare systems.
One of the things you all have looked at, which I found really interesting, was the administrative costs in the U.S. healthcare system. If you look at the NHS in the U.K., we heard from someone earlier on the NHS, or, say, the sickness funds in Germany, do they have the same kind of administrative costs that we see here?
So other countries do have administrative costs. What we see is that the U.S. typically has the greatest burden. When we ask doctors about their practice, in the U.S., more than 50% of doctors say it is a major problem, the amount of time they spend dealing with insurance and trying to get coverage for their patients. When we look across the countries that have multi-payer systems, which include the Netherlands, includes France, they have higher administrative costs. The countries that have single payer, the UK and Canada, they have the lowest administrative costs.
Let's play healthcare Tetris. So let's say that you could take a little bit from one system or a little bit from another. Like, where are the places that you would look for inspiration if you could add in little bits of other country systems to ours?
So I think when we're talking about the insurance side, it's not necessarily about having a national healthcare system and a single payer. What we see that's really interesting is different models work. So in the UK, you do have the National Health Service and single payer. But when people go to get healthcare, there's no deductible. There's no cost sharing. If you need to see your primary care doctor, you just see your primary care doctor. In France, if you have any one of 30 chronic conditions, you have no cost sharing.
Wow.
For both the primary care visit and for the prescription drugs. So the incentive is to encourage people who have diabetes, who have congestive heart failure, to make sure that they get the care they need, the best promotion for keeping well.
And I would imagine that that bends the cost curve on the other end, because people aren't ending up sort of in extremis needing then incredibly invasive care to fix a crisis.
It does. So all of that preventive care is sort of upstream, and it plays out in terms of people being healthier.
I need to ask you about the Netherlands, though, as an example, or any of these examples. The Netherlands is a tiny country with a relatively homogenous population. The United States is huge. We have all sorts of different people who live here, and we're just geographically really big. Can we transpose these models to a country like the United States?
I think we have the opportunity to transpose, not the whole model, and I don't think that would work even if we wanted to do it. But what we do have the chance to do is to take ideas and look at best practices in other countries. So there's a lot that can be learned on the front line from how do you provide the best care.
That was Robin Osborne from the Commonwealth Fund. We're starting a project here on Marketplace Weekend, and we want to hear about your healthcare stories. What you spend, what your thoughts are, what's working, and what's not. You can email us. We're weekend@marketplace.org. Leave us a voicemail. We'll call you back. 1-800-648-5114. And you can keep up to date with what we're doing on the show. Just subscribe to our newsletter at marketplace.org. This coming Wednesday, more than 180 companies will join an online protest called the Net Neutrality Day of Action, with tech giants like Google, Facebook, and Amazon teaming up with supporters to encourage the FCC, Federal Communications Commission, not to roll back the rules that say all internet content should be treated equally. Of course, the companies have a business interest here, too. Net neutrality is complicated. So to explain it and why you should care, we've got Marketplace tech host Ben Johnson. Take it away, Ben.
Net neutrality is a really boring phrase in a debate about something that is increasingly fundamental, the way that we access and use the internet. For the majority of the internet and the World Wide Web's existence, it's all been designed for equal access. If I try to visit whitehouse.gov, facebook.com, netflix.com, those pages will be equally easy and fast to get to. It only depends a little bit on how fast my internet provider's speed is and how well the websites are designed and run. Net neutrality is the idea that this basic equality design should continue. And it's important for users and businesses, because people in the free internet parts of the world kind of all agree that access to information in the internet age equals opportunity. And because if my website, benbrockjohnson.com, is trying to compete with netflix.com, I need to be just as able to find customers as the big dog, and customers need to be able to find me as well. that fundamental equality-focused design of the internet delivering information on the web and now wireless phone networks as well, that idea is harder and harder for internet service providers to swallow. Because according to them, even though there's precious little competition among broadband or even wireless internet companies like Comcast and Verizon, their costs of delivering the service are pretty high, digging trenches, laying cable, etc. And so their argument is basically that in order to keep generating revenue for shareholders, they need to innovate. And that means finding new ways to make money without the burden of regulation. How to make that money? Well, maybe it's stuff that you can only access or access faster when you're a Verizon customer. For instance, imagine you can stream more faster and more high-definition content from Netflix if your internet service provider is specifically Verizon. Or maybe you can only access your favorite NBC TV shows online if your internet service provider is Comcast, the parent company of NBC Universal. And the Federal Communications Commission under Ajit Pai and Donald Trump seems to favor this larger telecom industry argument. But a lot of users and companies that love the open Wild West history of the internet thus far, or simply don't want to fork over big fees to internet service providers to have access to those providers' users, are really worried about a world without net neutrality. That's why some of the top websites around the country are asking for their users to press the government to uphold net neutrality rules this coming week.
There you have it. And you can hear more about net neutrality next week on Marketplace Tech. Pretty healthy jobs report this Friday. Wages went up by 2.5% compared to last June. So let's stick with that wage thing. Last week on the show, you heard from two women living on minimum wage. One in Los Angeles, where the minimum wage just went up to $12 an hour. One in New Orleans, where it's $8.25 an hour. And just this week, there's news of a lowering of the minimum wage in St. Louis, Missouri, at the end of August. But today, we wanted to look at the issue from another angle. This week, a lot of you shared your thoughts. On Facebook, listener Joe Drozel wrote, "It's only going to get worse if we as a society continue to insist that the only jobs with merit are professional white-collar jobs that require a degree." On our website, small business owner Mark Pearson says, "I pay my employees based on their value to my business." Pearson's employees make above minimum wage where he lives because, and I quote, "they are the most important part of the success of my business." Mark brings up a point we saw a lot in the comments. When we talk about minimum wage, often we're really talking about the value of the employee to the company. Emil Avazov owns the restaurant 71 Above in Los Angeles, and he says that labor costs are a big deal in fine dining because there are so many people involved, both in the front and back of the house.
You don't just prep things and put it on a plate in a fine dining, refined atmosphere. So all that requires higher labor costs and higher labor hours in order to produce that experience.
In the restaurant world, labor costs can be up to 40% of your expenses, especially in high-end places. And while Emil is confident in his business plan, he thinks that raising the minimum wage, like what just happened in LA, could be a big problem for restaurants.
You don't have many operators thinking about year 10 or year 5 or year 20 because they're struggling to get to year 2.
But at the same time, Emil believes that it's still the business's responsibility to look out for its employees.
We get employees almost by category to a sustainable living wage. So we go out of our way to pay those folks.
But for Emil, hiking the minimum wage just may not be the right way to value those employees. So what is? We reached out to Michael Strain, a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, a right-leaning think tank. He's also a little skeptical of minimum wage hikes.
I think that the minimum wage often does eat into profit margins. I think that's a reasonably good outcome in many cases. And it's the outcome that a lot of minimum wage supporters hope happens, you know, especially in the context of, you know, really large, really profitable companies.
They're okay if McDonald's doesn't turn such a huge profit, basically.
That's exactly right. The bottom line is that a business has to absorb a minimum wage increase somehow. And, you know, it is reasonable to argue that one way businesses absorb minimum wage increases is through reduced turnover costs. One way is through higher productivity of workers. One way is through higher prices of output that businesses charge. And you know, one way is through reduced profits for the owners of businesses. I think, you know, my reading of the evidence is that another way that businesses absorb the cost of minimum wage increases is through hiring fewer workers. But you know, if the choice is businesses make less profit, you know, or businesses hire fewer workers, I would go with the less profit.
Labor costs, you know, vary significantly by industry, even at the lower end of the wage spectrum. Well, what's to, you know, stop employers from just saying, well, okay, I'm going to have a bunch of robots serve food then?
Well, I think that's a real risk. You know, I went into a McDonald's recently and for the first time saw that they had some kiosks that were up in the lobby, and you could type in your order. You didn't have to talk to a cashier. You could place your order with a machine. You know, I go into drugstores all the time and go to an automated cashier. Not a human being. Same thing at grocery stores. Same thing at movie theaters. So you know, this is not just something that might happen. I mean, this is something that is happening. And you know, if you kind of think about the decision that the business has to make, you know, minimum wages are going up. That means that my labor costs are going to be X, and they're going to be higher than they used to be. You know, that makes the price of investing in machines, the relative price go down. And so, you know, on the margin, you're going to see businesses start to make those decisions.
You had this line in a Q&A that I read that I found completely fascinating, which was businesses want to make money on their workforces. And we may not like it, but that's the reality of it. So assuming that's true, and, you know, that is part of the equation for an employer, is there some magic margin that they're shooting for, that they should be shooting for, where they say, yeah, I want Lizzie to produce kind of X thing for me, and I want to make a certain amount of money on her?
I don't know if there's a you know a magic margin or even a margin that's constant across firms or constant within industry or even constant, you know, over time across the same worker. You know, but I do think that businesses, you know, need to make decisions about whether a worker will add value to a firm in excess of what the firm is paying the worker.
I want to ask you a question I asked Gary Bertlis last week, because I think this is very important depending on sort of how one sees the minimum wage and where it fits into our national policy discussion. What do you think the purpose of the minimum wage is?
So I think that's the million-dollar question. If you think that the purpose of the minimum wage is to help households in, you know, roughly the bottom half of the income distribution or the wage distribution to earn more money, you know, then you may conclude that it's a good policy because it does do that. It comes at a cost, in my view, of fewer jobs for the least skilled, least experienced workers. But you know, maybe that cost is worth the benefit. If, on the other hand, you think that the purpose of the minimum wage should be to help the least skilled, least experienced workers in the economy to earn more money and to advance in their careers, then I think the minimum wage is a bad and ineffective policy.
Michael Strain is the Director of Economic Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
This has been a huge week in the electric car business. Electric vehicles have long been kind of the, oh, that's cool, but not a huge market share part of the car business. But now, Tesla says it's about to release its more affordable Model 3 version. And Volvo announced that starting in 2019, all of its new models will be electric or hybrid. Chevy and Nissan are already in on this game. We're going to look at electric cars now, starting with what it's like to own one.
My name is Angelo Logan. On January 1st, 2016, I leased a Volkswagen e-Golf, 100% battery electric vehicle. Now, when I first bought the electric vehicle, I thought that it was going to be seamless and no problem at all. But what I learned very quickly is that you have to be very conscientious about where you're going, how far you're going, where there's charging stations, whether or not you're going to have that distance that you need to go in your battery. A lot of people call this range anxiety, and I gotta tell you, that anxiety is real. The first month or so that I drove the vehicle, I actually got stranded because I depleted my battery and had nowhere to charge, and I had to call the tow truck. I drive 60 miles both to and from work, and my range is 80, so that means I have 20 miles to really play with, and I have to think about, you know, what meetings I might go to offsite, if I'm going to go somewhere after work, if I'm going to go to dinner or go to lunch, whether or not there's going to be charging stations available at work, whether there's going to be charging stations at all at the places that I might recreate afterwards for dinner or for drinks. But as I unplug the vehicle and I drive off to work, thinking about whether I can use or should use my air conditioning, because that depletes the charge as well. With all the anxiety, and as I come home and I plug in my vehicle and I have to check to make sure that light is blinking to make sure it's charging overnight, I know that I'm going to be able to sleep well that evening because I'm doing my part to reduce air pollution by driving an electric vehicle.
Okay, so let's dig into the production side of this a little and put the Volvo and Tesla news in context. I'm going to do that with Tracy Samilton, who covers the auto industry for Michigan Public Radio. So, Tracy, what's attracting the big automakers to electric vehicles?
It's not the attractiveness of it, I think. It's the necessity. What automakers are seeing is the future kind of barreling down on them in terms of policy. Countries all around the world are pushing automakers to move into electric vehicles. And it's the reality of climate change. They see what we're facing, and they know this is our future. And if they don't prepare now, they're not going to be able to sell vehicles 10 to 20 years from now.
You're in Michigan, the heart of the auto industry. How do what we've always called the big three position themselves now?
General Motors is kind of leading the way here. They have a very, very strong electrification program. They can do pretty much anything that an automaker needs to do right now to survive. Ford is, you know, trying to keep up. Their electrification program is perhaps not as advanced. And then Fiat Chrysler, I'm afraid, just does not have, it takes huge amounts of revenue to run these programs, billions. And I'm afraid Fiat Chrysler does not have that money.
I mean, we look at, say, the Chevy Volt, and, you know, is it doing well? Is it when we kind of look at the landscape of electric vehicles, it seems pretty popular.
You know, it in the past 6 months, the Chevy Volt has been the highest volume selling car in the United States among EVs and plug-in hybrid cars. So that doesn't mean that it's doing well in the bigger landscape. You look at the number of Volts that GM sold, it was 10,900 approximately. You know, just compare that to one top-selling crossover, maybe the Honda CR-V, and they sold 187,000 year-to-date. What will bring jobs is volume when more people than are buying them now start to buy electric vehicles. And a lot of things have to happen before that becomes the case.
Well, this brings me to this question about timing, right? Gas prices are quite low. Oil prices are extremely low. So is there a disincentive to push into electric vehicles? Or do the companies look past that to the larger sort of future trends?
Well, you know, if you can be like General Motors, you try to do it all. You try to meet this fast-growing demand for crossovers. You know, people are moving from, you know, slightly more fuel-efficient cars, sedans, into these crossovers. So you try to do it all. You're keeping your profits up. And then you are preparing for the future. So even with gas prices low right now, we don't know what's coming. We don't know whether a future Congress might increase fuel taxes or put a carbon tax on cars with internal combustion engines. And car companies have to be prepared for anything that might happen in the future. And they really do seem to all agree the future is electric.
Tracy Samilton covers the auto industry for Michigan Radio. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. It's a pleasure.
If the car companies are going electric, well, how do you charge yours? And do some of the technical limitations change your behavior? Ethan Elkind is the director of the Climate Change and Business Program at UCLA, and he published a paper on electric vehicle charging infrastructure. He says that right now we don't see a lot of chargers, partly because they're in people's homes, and partly because the demand for public chargers just isn't there yet. But the need is growing, and power companies may be the ones who have to step up.
Well, ideally, there's a business model for it, and just like we don't need to subsidize gas stations, that these are profitable enterprises. But the challenge here is that right now there really isn't as much of a business model as we would hope for the number of charging stations that we need. So certainly some of the money to pay for these could come from individuals who plug their cars in and then pay like they would pay for gas. But there may need to be other ways of getting this infrastructure paid for. So for example, having retail sales on site, just like when you go to a gas station, you might go and buy a Slurpee or whatever you might want out of the convenience store right there. That can help pay for the fuel that you're getting. But we're also probably going to need electric utilities to invest in these charging stations as well.
So let's spin this out a little bit. Let's say that Tesla continues to grow. We've now got Volvo, the Volt. I mean, lots of different kinds of car companies. Could we end up in a proprietary charging system situation? Like you can only use an Apple or an Android. Is there a agreed upon way to do this, or can companies write their own rules?
Well, we have seen some format wars, kind of akin to the old VHS Betamax battle that happened, where when it comes to fast charging your vehicle, not if you're just going obviously through a regular wall outlet or through the 240 volt outlet like a dryer machine, would have. But for the fast chargers, we did see a bit of competition between European, North American, and then the Asian automakers. But I think that format war will end as the next generation of fast chargers come out. But I think, to your point, we're seeing Tesla, for example, kind of replicating that Apple, ecosystem kind of model where you've got your Tesla vehicle and you're only going to charge at a Tesla charger. Although the fact is Teslas can charge at all these public charging spots as well. And there's been innovation to make sure that there's interoperability. But I think most automakers, certainly the ones that I've spoken with, I think they're not interested in getting into the charging business. I think Tesla is a bit of an outlier there. So at this point, I don't think that's a concern, but clearly Tesla is kind of going in that direction.
Wow. If you could design systems to implement across the country, what would you do?
Well, we definitely need more infrastructure, and it's a fairly urgent thing because the electric vehicle market, as you mentioned, Volvo, the automakers are really committed to this now, and battery costs have come down dramatically, almost 80% in the last 7-8 years or so. So the prices of the vehicles have come way down as well. They've basically been cut in half. We want to see the rollout, but we do need more of this infrastructure very quickly. And I think utility investments do make the most sense. Utilities have the capital to do this. They have the expertise to help with that wiring, and they can really bring down the costs of installing these charging stations. That's going to be critical, but there are other ways to bring down the costs as well. We can design electricity rates better. We can cut costs that way, but we can also help with utility investments. And I think those kind of twin approaches could make a huge difference in this country for the vehicle charging infrastructure that we need.
Ethan Elkind is the director of the Climate Change and Business Program at UCLA. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
We've spent a lot of time on this show digging into the issue of student debt. 44 million Americans owe some kind of education-related loan, a total of $1.3 trillion. And yes, for many people, the earnings premium that comes with a college degree makes the loans worth it. But that doesn't mean that debt isn't incredibly taxing, financially, emotionally, and psychologically. And today, we are teaming up with WNYC's podcast, Death, Sex, and Money, They've been gathering stories about the effects debt has on people's lives.
The overwhelming theme was that it feels like for a lot of people who are making monthly student loan payments or maybe struggling with those payments, it feels like a secret and it feels shameful.
That's Anna Sale, host of the Death, Sex, and Money podcast.
The statistics show that the amount of student debt has increased 170% in the last 10 years. More Americans are taking out more debt, and they're taking longer to pay it off. So this is an increasingly common experience, but I don't think the way we talk about student debt socially or out in the open has caught up with that.
We did a fair amount of reporting on student debt last summer, and one of the things I was struck by was the psychology of it. In the responses you got from listeners, do you think the way they related to their student debt was different from, say, credit card debt or mortgage debt, car loans, etc.?
Well, I think the thing about student loan debt is you think you're doing the responsible thing when you get educated, when you decide to get that degree, maybe go to grad school, that you're doing the thing that's going to set you up for success. And so when in the end it ends up being a financial situation when you're graduated that maybe your degree is not what you thought it was going to be worth, or your payments are much higher than you thought they were going to be, then there's a sense of like, wait, this wasn't what I was told. I was told if I got educated, if I got into these elite schools, I was setting myself up for success. So there's a sense of like, oh my God, how did I get duped here? And also, God, I'm educated. How did I get myself in this situation? So it's this mix of shame and also frustration with the system.
I want to play some of the responses you got. First from Jordan in the Bay Area, who is not paying on her loans right now. Tell us about her backstory. Set up this clip for us.
Yeah, she sent us an email and she said, I'm a recent graduate. I've been out of college for more than 2 years now, and I've never made a payment on my federal student loan. And so I said, well, Jordan, why don't we talk about what's going on? And so she came in and we talked about that.
I want to project out that, like, I'm successful and I'm doing well, even if I'm not doing as well as I'm projecting. It's like a really bad state of denial, like, I'm, like, fake rich, you know what I mean? Like, I'd rather spend money and look rich than actually, like, take care of the debts that I have on my own.
What is that about, that sort of sense of I am projecting via social media or whatever that I'm fine?
Yeah, well, in her case, you know, she's 2 years out of school, and she got her first student loan payment bill right after college, and it was about $700 a month, and she just thought, I can't afford this, so I'm not going to pay it. So she didn't pay. And then she got another job that paid better. And now she works at Facebook that pays better. And now she can afford her student loan payments, but she hasn't felt the pain of having not paid them for 2 years. So when I first talked to her, she was in that sense of, I'm going to spend my money on things that are going to be fun and that make me look like I'm a success.
I want to play some sound from a woman you identify as Vivian. When we talk about debt really changing someone's life circumstances, let's play that, and then we can talk about it a little bit.
Those private student loans have ruined my life. So, to be frank, I ended up remarrying my ex-husband because I couldn't afford to pay my bills.
I mean, just listening to her voice, there is so much pain there. What happened, and how did she end up making the decision to remarry her ex-husband because of her loans?
This was one of the most heartbreaking stories that we heard. This is a woman who asked to go by Vivian. That's not her real name. But when she was going to college, she first started out at community college. She got a walk-on athletic scholarship when she went to a four-year university. So she did all the things that they tell you to do to keep your financial costs down when you're in college.
Yeah.
But then one mistake she made is she took out private loans. And those loans, they don't have income-based repayment like federal loans can. And she got into a situation after she divorced her husband. They had two kids together. She went back into the workforce. She'd been a stay-at-home mom, and she wasn't making enough money for her private student loan payments. And her wages ended up being garnished. So then she finds herself on food stamps, and she can't support her kids. And so she makes the decision with her ex-husband to get back together to try to make it financially to pay back her student loans. I mean, that was the main driver. That debt is what caused them to reconcile and to get remarried. And ended up creating another set of complications because he was on income-based repayment for his student loans, and that increased his income when they got married. So after 2.5 years of being back together, now they are pursuing divorce again.
Anna Sale is the host of the WNYC podcast, Death, Sex, and Money. And you can find a link to her student loan project on our website, marketplace.org. Anna, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Question time. Have you been to the movies this summer? And if the answer's no, you're not alone. Summer box office numbers have been in decline this year as the studios roll out a lot of franchise remakes and sequels, like the new version of The Mummy.
Am I dead?
You are alive because of what you brought on that plane.
Or the fifth Pirates of the Caribbean.
Pirates had infected the seas for generations, so I vowed to eliminate them all.
Bad reviews probably aren't helping draw domestic audiences, though these movies are doing okay overseas. Over at The Atlantic, David Sims writes that Hollywood does not necessarily have a sequel problem, more of a bad movie problem. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So why are so many movies doing poorly in terms of their domestic box office this summer? I mean, is it just because they're bad?
The simplest way to put it is they're bad. But I think if you think of Hollywood as an entity that, you know, responds to market forces and tries to sort of interpret trends in terms of like what it's seeing in the box office, what movies are doing well, what movies are not doing so well, it's like studios have started to ignore a lot of the traditional metrics there for the last couple of years. And they're giving us sequels that, like, by all accounts, you know, audiences, certainly audiences in America, are not that excited for. So, you know, we're getting, like, a fifth Pirates of the Caribbean movie. We're getting a fifth Transformers movie. We're getting a lot of these kind of desperate plays just to sort of, like, keep a brand going. Even though the previous sequel in each of these franchises had already been like sort of a down sequel, you know, had not really been a hit with audiences.
Yeah, so why make them?
The excuse has always been in recent years that the international money is good, you know. So even if, say, Pirates 5 doesn't make even make back its huge budget in America, it doesn't matter because, you know, it does great internationally. It does great in China. It does great in Europe. Like, the worldwide box office total, which even like 10, 15 years ago wasn't really something a studio would worry about that much, now that's how you get these movies to make their money back. But, you know, you roll them out globally all at once, and you sort of score this giant take in your first 3 days around the world to justify like the expense of these productions, which is considerable.
Well, I guess this leads me to the question that, does it matter if Americans go to the movies if, say, people in China are going to the movies?
I feel like that is the sort of nihilistic answer to all of this right now. But it feels like sort of a short-term bet to me. Like, You can't be a studio that's, you know, an American studio that obviously you're making a product for a global market, but you can't exactly say that your biggest market, America, is kind of beside the point for you. You know, I mean, Hollywood's domination of the worldwide box office is not some guaranteed thing, and nor is it probably going to last forever. Like, you have studios in China that are becoming, you know, bigger and much more adept at mounting these kind of productions and making movies for their audiences that are, you know, a lot better received than, say, a Transformers 5. And, you know, in the short term, yeah, maybe you can cover your losses just by making these big franchises and sort of keeping them going as long as possible, but that doesn't strike me as a strategy that's sort of going to sustain cinema.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the U.S. box office, and you've written about this, you know, Get Out, which did not cost a lot of money to make, was very profitable here.
Yeah, you've got a lot of movies this year especially that bet on good directors, bet on people with interesting ideas, bet on scripts that have a lot of potential, you know, movies that don't have to cost upwards of $200 million just to make them. Forget marketing them. You just, you know, you have to spend hundreds of millions just to make the things. And a movie like Get Out, which only cost a few million dollars, suddenly can earn you a giant profit.
So let's say you have the ear of the studio heads in America. What would you tell them to do?
Well, it's interesting because one of the problems, I think, is that there's one studio in America that has made a big bet on franchises that has worked, and that's Disney. It's got the Marvel movies, it's got the Pixar movies, and it's doing these remakes of
Star Wars now.
And it's got Star Wars. And so I think a lot of the other studios, your Universal, which is trying to mount this dark universe franchise that's sort of based around horror movies, they tried that with The Mummy this year. They're looking at that and they're thinking, well, maybe we should try to do that too. But my advice to a lot of these studios would be, like, look at a movie like Get Out, look at a movie like Split, which was another Universal movie that did very well this year on very little money. You know, look at sort of genre films, horror films, action films, romances, teen movies. Like, people still like to go see these movies in the theaters if they're good. People respond to good movies. You've got studios out here complaining that critics are negatively influencing the sort of box office totals of some of these bigger flops, like Baywatch, for example. But, you know, on the flip side, if you're saying critics have any influence at all, then there's a lot to be gained if you sort of make a little more of a bet on quality.
Well, so does that mean that, you know, the summer blockbuster, as we know it, is a thing of the past?
I mean, not at all. Because, again, you look at the top 10, I think, of 2017. You know, right at the top there, you've got movies like Wonder Woman, you have Guardians of the Galaxy 2, you have The Fate of the Furious. Those are films that are doing great. Obviously, audiences want them. It's not like there's no room for a big-budget sort of blockbuster in Hollywood, especially in the summertime. The problem is, those used to be exciting tentpoles, and the best ones would rise to the top. But now, like, every week, there are two of these things, basically, in theaters that audiences have to pick from, and very little else. Like, it's not so much the blockbuster is the problem, it's the lack of variety that I think audiences are starting to get tired of.
David Sims is a senior editor at The Atlantic, where he covers culture. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
One thing we like to do here is ask people from the world of the arts, whether they are actors, writers, musicians, whatever, about their experiences with work and money, what shaped them, and what they've learned along the way.
Hi, this is Jade Chang. I'm the author of The Wangs Versus the World. Fill in the blank. Money can't buy you happiness, but it can buy you...
Oh, you know, I think that is something that only people who were born with a lot of money and who are sure that they're going to also die with a lot of money, that's something that only those people think. Because I think that for anyone else in the world, yeah, money can buy you happiness. It's not that like one material item is going to buy you happiness. It's that, you know, when you go from making, let's say, like $35,000 a year to like over $60,000 a year, the amount of relief and freedom, you know, that you get in that is, it looks a lot like happiness to me.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's all the little things of, okay, for example, today when I came to this radio station, you know, you pull into one of those office parking lots and you kind of hope the people are going to validate your parking. But let's say 10 years ago, if I had seen the prices, you know, it's like, what, $3.25 to park for 15 minutes? I probably would have tried really hard to find street parking just in case you didn't. And now I feel like, all right, if they don't validate, maybe I'll be out $15, but I can handle that.
I promise that we'll validate your parking.
I figured you would. But you know, I do think that those things make an enormous difference in your daily quality of life.
In a next life, what would your career be?
I'd say the practical answer is I'd love to be an illustrator. But if I could choose anything, if I could sing at all, like even a tiny bit, I would love to write and perform music. But honestly, if you could like come back as something different in your next life, I'd probably choose to be an otter. I mean, why not?
An otter?
Yeah, they're so resourceful and cute.
All right, so we have illustrator, singer, and otter.
Yes.
What is the hardest part about your job that nobody knows?
I think It would probably be the waiting. First of all, it takes forever to write a book. So you're waiting for yourself to finish it. Mm-hmm. And then you wait for agents to read your manuscript. Once you manage to sell the book, you wait for it to be published, which I sold this book in April of 2015, and it was published in October of 2016, which seemed like forever to me, but other people who have more experience in publishing were like, wow, that's barely any time to wait. So,
what do you do with yourself during all that
waiting?
Yeah, how do you keep yourself occupied?
A lot of naps.
What is something everyone should own no matter the cost?
So I think everyone should own a pair of shoes that they feel very, very comfortable in. And I mean both emotionally and physically comfortable in. Because to me, freedom is kind of the most important thing that you can have. And, you know, you want to be able to walk through the world easily. Mm-hmm. And a pair of shoes helps.
What advice do you wish someone had given you before you started your career?
Honestly, the advice that would be the most helpful right now is think of answers to questions like this beforehand. Like, the question of which writers have influenced your writing.
Mm.
Every time someone asks me that, I'm like, hold on, let me think. You know, it's like when someone asks you your favorite color when you're an adult, you just kind of think, I don't know. There's all the colors serve different purposes, and I love them all.
Jade Chang's new book, The Wangs Versus the World, is out in paperback now. And that quiz was produced by Haley Hirschman. And that's our show for this week. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills and Sean McHenry. Joanne Griffith is our senior producer. Bill Lance is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our vice president and general manager. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.